Our next case is number 19-1098, Serta Simmons Bedding LLC versus Casper Sleep Inc. Mr. Schoenhardt?
Thank you, Judge Dyke. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This appeal is perplexing, as it strikes me that it should be rather straightforward. Here, Serta Simmons asks this Court to vacate the judgment of the District Court below, to reverse the District Court's decision that it was unable to enforce the party's settlement agreement, to vacate the judge's entry of summary judgment, which was itself void at the time it was entered for lack of case or controversy, and to remand with instructions to enforce the party's settlement agreement. Everything that we are asking boils down to one very simple fact, which I believe to be undisputed, that on June 18, 2018, the parties entered into a binding settlement agreement that resolved all issues in the underlying case. At that moment, there was no longer case or controversy.
When was the court notified of this agreement, and how was the court notified?
I appreciate Your Honor's question, and as to the first portion, the court was notified on the very same day that the settlement agreement was executed, that being June 18, 2018. The court was notified by the filing of a joint paper that was a notice of settlement agreement and a request to stay the case. The request to stay, of course, is not uncommon in the post-Kokkonen world, in which the Supreme Court had explained that district courts did not have power to enforce settlement agreements after dismissal was entered, and as a result, it became quite common for parties to ask to delay entry pending payment of a settlement payment so that if there were concerns over that payment, there was no need to file a later separate action. The district court would retain jurisdiction over it.
What did the district court say in its judgment 2 days later with regard to the settlement?
The district court said nothing specifically with regard to the settlement in its judgment 2 days later. In the judgment that issued on June 20, the district court dismissed as moot, or denied as moot, the party's request for a stay. The court did not in any way expressly reference the fact that the parties had entered into a settlement agreement or had so notified the court. Instead, the court went ahead and entered a summary judgment of non-infringement.
Is there any reason to think that the district court was not aware of the settlement?
I believe that the district court was perhaps not aware of the terms of the settlement. Those had not at that point been provided to the court, but there is no reason to believe the court was unaware that a settlement agreement had been entered. And in fact, in the court's subsequent order denying the motion to enforce, the court acknowledged that the parties had filed a notice of settlement agreement, but that the court was unaware of its terms at that time. Regardless what the court was aware, once Article III standing is removed, any court action thereafter is in fact void, regardless whether the court had notice of the settlement. That does not mean that in some way, the court should be reprimanded for having entered an order not fully appreciating the party's settlement. Rather, the simple course is to vacate the court's judgment, or at the district court level, for the district court to alter, amend, or remove its judgment as having been void when issued. This is not the
Casper argues that the agreement wasn't formed or executed because payment had not yet been made. Is that correct? That's their argument? And what is your response to that?
That is correct. That is, in fact, their argument. I don't think it's an argument with merit. And in fact, on remand, we intend to seek attorney's fees for what we view to be frivolous behavior. Here, we have a scenario, and I don't use the word frivolous lightly. This case concerns me. We have a scenario where we have a undisputedly fully executed settlement agreement. The majority of the primary cases that we cite to here are cases in which parties had reached settlement terms or had exchanged draft settlement agreements. This case is actually rather unique in that we, in fact, had a fully executed settlement agreement that on its face was effective as of the time when it was finally signed. For instance, I refer your honors to section 1.1 of the settlement agreement. This is in the appendix at 1867. That identifies the effective date as the last date of execution. I also note that the term provision, section 5.1, this is in the appendix at 1869, states that the agreement is effective when fully executed and will continue until the expiration of the underlying patents.
And the signature dates on the contract are June 18th.
Correct. Right? Both parties signed on June 18th. At that time, fully executed, fully binding. And in fact, in Casper's representations and warranties, section 7.2, this is in the appendix at 1871, Casper represented and warranted that the agreement was binding upon Casper and enforceable against it. To the extent,
what do you think Casper could do, though, when the district court says, I don't think I am bound by this settlement agreement. I'm going to go ahead and issue my summary judgment determination. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I understand your argument to be that performance was, that the settlement agreement was already formed and that the performance limitation was just something that had to be, it was like an obligation to the contract, not something that prevented it from being executed. But with respect to your comment about attorney fees, I just wonder, arguing that it's frivolous when the district court has an order specifically saying, I'm going to enter summary judgment and this settlement agreement wasn't executed. How can an appellee or a party not rely on that?
The district court did not, at the time it entered its order, say that this agreement was not fully executed. At the time it entered its summary judgment order, the district court did no more than deny as moot what was on the docket as a motion to stay. It was titled a motion, a notice of settlement agreement and motion to stay. The court referenced it simply as a motion to stay. What ought parties have done in a circumstance like this is to advise the court jointly that in fact there was a settlement, that the court's entry of summary judgment was void ab initio.
A red herring by talking about attorney's fees. I don't think you want to talk about attorney's fees here.
I'm happy, Your Honor, not to discuss it any further.
Well, let's discuss, though, the background to that. Casper complains at length about the litigating behavior of Serta in this case, and if their description is correct, and I don't know whether it is or not, but it sounds like the district court might have been pretty ticked off at Serta's behavior, which might account for the, if you will, summary judgment. Do you have any comment about that?
I don't think I can fairly comment on the demeanor of the district court at the time, but I do believe it's fair to say that the district court, in fact, entered a order of summary judgment of non-infringement, but as a matter of law, that order was void at the time it was entered in view of a settlement agreement. Had Casper, in fact, believed as strongly in its positions then as it does now, Casper likely would not have entered into such a settlement. In fact, the reason courts recognize and respect settlements to the extent they do is that settlements themselves recognize the uncertainties of litigation and litigants' interests in avoiding the uncertainties of those litigations to resolve their disputes. It may be notable that the actual payment term is not a large, significant sum, at least in the world of corporations. That, of course, is not the most significant term in the settlement agreement. As the product had not been on the market for an extended period of time and had not shown significant profit from which any damage would be derived. The significant term of the settlement was, in fact, the cease and desist term, whereby Casper agreed to redesign its product. And, in fact, that was the second time Casper had attempted a redesign. The first redesign was unsatisfactory. Casper redesigned its product for yet a second time to avoid the patents that are at issue. Accordingly, there was specific and significant value to be derived from this settlement by the parties in that it eliminated any further uncertainty of litigation on an ongoing basis. The parties recognized that uncertainty within the recitals of the settlement agreement in the appendix of 1867, where the parties, using somewhat standard language, expressed their desire to settle all claims and to avoid uncertainty.
I take it that your lengthy answer, in effect, says you don't have any quarrel with their description of the behavior of CERTA's attorneys during the course of the litigation.
Well, I certainly do, Your Honor, and I apologize if I misunderstood your question. I understood you to be referring to the district court's view of it. In my view, our behavior...
We can only hypothesize about the district court's view, so you're correct not to deal with that. But their description of the litigating context, do you disagree with their description?
I do, Your Honor, and this is, of course, the subject of their cross-appeal, and we have addressed this in our response to cross-appeal at some length, referring point to point to the issues they raise. The primary issue they seem to raise is, frankly, one of claim construction, that to Casper, from day one, they took a different view of the claims than did CERTA Simmons. And as a result, in their view, no request for preliminary injunction ever should have been sought. To CERTA Simmons, of course, when a new product hits the market and has just been released, that is when a request for preliminary injunction is, in fact, the most appropriate time to so make a request. But thereafter, the parties engaged in a rather heated litigation, largely focused on claim construction. The district court initially entered a claim construction that would have tilted in favor of Casper. And CERTA Simmons, as was appropriate, requested reconsideration of that claim construction. The district court then, in fact, did reconsider its claim construction order, entered a claim construction that highly favored CERTA Simmons. And on the plain language of the district court's claim construction, there could be no dispute that the claim was infringed. Ultimately, then at the time of summary judgment, the district court did not further expressly modify its claim construction, but now the district court seemed to have implicitly backed off of its claim construction in view of what it identified as a prosecution history disclaimer. What that course of dealings suggests is, in fact, a highly contested litigation largely focused on an issue of claim construction that was itself hotly contested, and that at different stages, the district court tipped in one party's favor or the other as it was swayed from side to side.
Okay, you're into your rebuttal time. You want to save it?
I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dominguez?
Good morning, and may it please the court, Kate Dominguez for Casper.
What's supposed to happen here, under your view, if CERTA goes to state court and state court determines that the agreement is enforceable and rejects any theories that you have as to its not being enforceable, and then we have this district court judgment which says there's no infringement? How are the courts supposed to reconcile those two judgments?
A state court judgment, and of course we would think that would be wrong, but a state court judgment that did not find frustration of purpose discharging Casper's payment obligations would have no effect on the district court's summary judgment order. The two are not related.
So we have a judgment that the settlement agreement is enforceable and a determination of non-infringement. Those can coexist?
Your Honor, the district court had...
No, what's the answer to that?
Those can coexist. The reason is that the district court on June 20th, when it entered its summary judgment, had jurisdiction over the case. The case was not moot. So it had, and by the way, counsel for CERTA just...
If the agreement was enforceable, then would they be able to come in and move to vacate the district court judgment under Rule 60?
They would not, and let me explain why. So counsel for CERTA stood up here and actually conceded that the case was not moot. He stood up here and told this panel that if there's no Article III jurisdiction, the court doesn't have power to act. At the same time, he told the panel that the court did have power to act in this case, power to grant substantive relief to CERTA to enforce the agreement.
I don't see the inconsistency there, but... Why doesn't a case become moot when the parties settle it, even if there are terms that have to be implemented under the agreement? Why doesn't that moot the case?
Under the Gould and Selke cases in the Seventh Circuit, those cases make clear that the settlement has to be final. So if the settlement finally resolves...
Well, but those cases don't bind us. We have cases that Exigent, for example, that deal with similar situations which suggest that a binding settlement agreement does move the case.
So you're right, Your Honor. The Seventh Circuit doesn't bind this court, but the Constitution does. The Constitution doesn't say anything about settlements. The Constitution...
Why would it say something about settlements? There are all sorts of things it doesn't say something about.
Exactly. Article 3 speaks to cases or controversies. So the key issue has to be, was there a live case or controversy on June 20th? If a settlement agreement does not resolve the controversy between the parties on the day that it's signed, it doesn't moot the case.
And you're relying on Seventh Circuit law for that position?
We cite two Seventh Circuit cases for that proposition.
I mean, that's not even the regional circuit that's applicable here, right? If we were to look to regional circuit law, it wouldn't be the Seventh Circuit. Is
the Second
right?
Circuit law is perfectly consistent with that. In fact, in the Second Circuit, there's case law holding that a tentative settlement does not move.
What makes this
tentative settlement?
The same case holds that in that case, two parties had signed and exchanged dismissals but simply not submitted them to the court yet. And the Second Circuit held that the case was not moot because those had not been submitted to the court.
It had not been submitted to the court. Are you saying this settlement had not been submitted to the court before the summary judgment was issued?
That's right, Your Honor. So per the parties' agreement, the parties bargained to keep the case alive. In fact, CERTA tells us in its brief at page 12.
But the court was advised about the settlement, right?
Yeah.
Before
yeah.
we acted.
Don't tell us what's in the settlement. Tell us what, my question is, are you saying that the court was not notified of a fact, of a settlement fact?
The court was notified that there was an agreement that intended to resolve the issues in controversy, not that it did. And notably, the parties did not file a Rule 41 dismissal. A Rule 41 dismissal
where,
would
where
have
do we noted, find what the court was told?
If you turn to the
it's
notice.
It's 1839.
Yes, 1839. So the language I was referring to, and let me know if Your Honor needs a minute to get to that page. The language I was referring to states that the parties have entered into a settlement agreement, the terms of which are intended to resolve the matters in controversy in the instant litigation. Accordingly,
what's ambiguous about that?
I actually think it's unambiguous. It tells the court not that there is a resolved case.
Wait a minute, read it again, please. Maybe I misunderstood it.
The parties have entered into a settlement agreement.
Stop right there. The parties have entered into a settlement agreement. Positive. Okay.
Yes,
then,
Your Honor.
Then the next sentence?
The terms of which are intended to resolve the matters in controversy.
Why isn't that an accurate description of what the settlement agreement was intended to do?
It is accurate, Your Honor. And if you look at the terms of the agreement, it says on its face that at the time the parties submit this motion to stay, it will be pending final settlement. It says that verbatim in the agreement. The agreement by its terms contemplated that it would not be final, the settlement would not be final on the day that the parties submitted the motion to stay. And CERTA actually explains.
Tell me again, where did the agreement say that?
Sure. So if you turn to the settlement agreement, and if you turn specifically to Appendix 1868, and you look to Section 2.2, it says, immediately upon full execution of this settlement agreement, the parties will cause their respective counsel to file a joint motion to stay the litigation pending final settlement.
But you don't dispute that the agreement resolved the case, right?
At the time it was intended to ultimately resolve the case, but at the time it was signed and
you
on June 20th.
You dispute that the agreement was binding apart from this argument that you make about frustration of purpose. It was binding, right? At the time it was executed, it was binding.
It was binding, yes. Just like the signed agreements in Gould and Selke.
Well,
doesn't that end the case?
This settlement agreement did not end the case on June 18th when it was signed. There was no final settlement on June 20th when the district court entered its summary judgment order. And therefore, again, because CERTA bargained to keep the case alive, it it said that in its brief, that it was unsure about payment, and so it negotiated to keep the case alive. It could have done something different. It could have negotiated to file an immediate Rule 41 dismissal, which is self-executing.
What do you mean it negotiated to keep the case alive? The settlement agreement resolved the case.
Your Honor, counsel for Serta stood up here and told Your Honor that it was the intention of the parties to keep the case open for purposes of enforcement.
A consent judgment resolves the case, but that doesn't prevent the court from having jurisdiction to enforce the consent judgment.
It depends on what the consent judgment includes, Your Honor. Under Kekkonen, in order to have jurisdiction to enforce, the court would have had to incorporate the settlement agreement into an order so that under ancillary jurisdiction, it was exercising its powers to enforce its own orders. Or potentially, although Kekkonen rejects this proposition, it would have to be ancillary in the sense of that it involved the same case or controversy. Kekkonen actually said it didn't apply that leg of ancillary jurisdiction, and I think it equally would not apply here. But those are the only two bases for a district court to have jurisdiction to enforce a settlement agreement. Neither of those are present here.
So let me be sure I understand your argument. Your position boils down to one rather specific question, and that is, was this a settlement agreement, a final settlement agreement, even though there were things yet to be performed? Your position is that was not a binding settlement agreement at the time it was entered into. Is that the case?
Not quite. The agreement was binding. There's no dispute about that.
The agreement
the question was
binding.
When signed, did it,
it was
fully
a settlement
resolve?
It was a settlement agreement that was binding on the parties. You agree to that?
It was a settlement agreement that was binding on the parties,
yes.
The terms of which ultimately, had everything been carried out, would have resolved the case. However, just like in Gould and Sutton,
not resolved the case, it would have resolved the settlement agreement.
If the
it didn't say anything about the case. That's for us to decide whether it resolved the case. But
well,
the question is, was the settlement agreement a binding agreement with future performance to be provided?
The settlement agreement was an agreement that was binding on the parties to carry out the steps therein, and specifically provided that there would be no dismissal and no release, and therefore no resolution of the controversy between the parties on the date it was signed. That was the state of play on June 20th when the district court entered its summary judgment order.
And you get there by your reading of the settlement agreement?
By the plain words of the settlement agreement that say in section 2.2 that the motion to stay was pending final settlement.
Thank you.
If we disagree with you and think that a settlement agreement was formed and executed and that there was no longer Article 3 case or controversy, and then we vacate the summary judgment, what else do you think should happen? I mean, I'm just wondering procedurally, what is going to happen? Opposing counsel is asking that we remand with instructions to enforce the settlement agreement. What is your position on that?
So if this court were to find that there was no case or controversy, that the case was moot on June 20th, such that the district court did not have power to enter the summary judgment order, then the case was moot for all purposes.
Including enforcement?
Including enforcement. Kekkonen is
but
absolutely clear about that.
There are lots of cases that say the opposite. There are lots of cases that say that the district court retains jurisdiction for enforcement.
The district court must retain jurisdiction. In this case, it did not. This is what Kekkonen changed about the law. Prior to Kekkonen, and I would note that Serta cites many pre-Kekkonen cases that talk about an inherent power, Kekkonen rejected that. Kekkonen said there is no inherent power to enforce. It has to come
from
somewhere.
It's not dealing with situations where there's a settlement before the judgment. Kekkonen is not dealing with this situation. It's not dealing with situations in which there's a settlement agreement before the court enters judgment.
I'm not sure if that's correct, Your Honor. It deals with when the court has jurisdiction to entertain a motion to enforce. And what it makes clear is that a district court does not have inherent power to enforce a state court contract between two parties, even though it settles the case. It has to come from ancillary jurisdiction, meaning in Kekkonen, it related to whether a court had the power to enforce its own orders. And the court there, like
but
here...
In Kekkonen, the settlement was reached after the district court's judgment, right?
In Kekkonen, the settlement... I'm not sure the timing of the settlement, but what I know, Your Honor, is that when the motion to enforce was brought, the case was closed. And so the court had not incorporated the terms of the settlement or stated that the settlement was so ordered. And actually, now I recall, so what happened was the parties came to the court and they recited the terms of their agreement, which the court heard but did not incorporate into any order.
Well, maybe we should direct the district court to incorporate the settlement agreement in order.
I don't think this court has power to do that. It's discretionary on the district court. The district court has discretion to decide whether to entertain an enforcement motion over a state court matter. It has that discretion if it has jurisdiction, but as we've made clear, in this case, under Kekkonen, there was no jurisdiction to entertain that motion.
We can always find that the district court's decision was an abuse of discretion, can't we?
Not in this case, Your Honor.
Okay.
I see I'm cutting into my rebuttal time. I'm happy to keep going if the court does not have questions on the cross appeal. If there are questions on the cross appeal, I'd like to reserve my time.
I have one quick question remaining, which is you spent a lot of time discussing their bad behavior. Why did you do what was the point of that? What did you want us to get from that?
Your Honor, there were discovery abuses in this case that I believe if a court does not sanction, they invite. There's the issue of the merits, and I think those speak for themselves. This is a case in which the merits were so strong, the district court saw a motion to stay pending settlement and denied it, and within 48 hours issued a summary judgment ruling totally vindicating Casper. That's the merits. But when you look to the discovery conduct, this is a case in which,
the attorney's fees issue becomes moot if we rule against you on the settlement agreement, right? You're no longer a prevailing party.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you.
Mr. Schoenhardt.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few notes briefly. As to Kekkonen, I think it's easy to get Kekkonen very confused, but I think that it can be readily dispensed with. Kekkonen addressed a situation in which the parties had, in fact, entered a stipulated dismissal. The Supreme Court was addressing whether the court retained jurisdiction to enforce a settlement agreement after that dismissal had been filed. Here, the parties did not get to the point of that dismissal. In fact, that's why in the post-Kekkonen world, parties generally ask a court to stay pending such things as a settlement payment rather than immediately dismissing cases. I don't think Kekkonen gets us anywhere. What does get us someplace is this court's and the Second Circuit's decisions, this court indeed post-Kekkonen, addressing what to do where there is a settlement. This court's cases in Exigent and Gould, and of course not to be confused, Casper cites to a Seventh Circuit Gould case. We cite to a Federal Circuit Gould case. But this court's decisions in Exigent and Gould both advise that where there is a fully executed settlement agreement, then it is appropriate to vacate the decision below and remand for enforcement of the agreement. There is a reverse and a remand in Exigent. Similarly, in Gould, that is the appropriate course of conduct. Exigent was 2006. That's over a decade after Kekkonen. This court was well aware of the Kekkonen decision and what its implication would be. Whereas in Exigent, and as in here, and you'll note that the Exigent case is very similar to this in that there was a grant of summary judgment of non-infringement and also invalidity and unenforceability claims that were not addressed, just as the district court here did not address those claims in its June 20 summary judgment. I would also refer you to the Second Circuit's decision in Jana that does predate Kekkonen, but it points out that this circuit and the Second Circuit are aligned on how to address situations like this. In Jana, the Second Circuit ordered a reverse and remand with instructions to enforce. In that case, unlike this, the settlement at issue had not even been fully executed. Rather, the parties had reached a settlement in principle, and the court stated at 436 of its decision, a binding settlement was reached and should have been enforced. A settlement is a contract, and once entered into, is binding and conclusive. So too here. I note that Ms. Dominguez referred to the language out of the payment term here that references pending final settlement. The distinction is actually whether a settlement is fully performed and final, or whether the settlement agreement itself is. Here, the settlement agreement itself was fully executed, and as Ms. Dominguez acknowledges, was binding at the time it was fully executed.
Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank you, Mr. Schoenhardt.
And thank you, Your Honor.
There wasn't any discussion of the cross appeal, so there's no occasion for rebuttal. Okay, thank all counsel. The case is submitted.